Plum ale and peppermint tea had only made Lizzie vomit. Quinine was what you gave people for malaria. That's what she needed. But she had no idea whether it was even called quinine here, or how it was administered. Malaria was an old disease, though, and quinine came from plants. Surely a doctor would have some, whatever it was called. Only the hope of finding medical help had kept her going through Lizzie's second bout. Afraid to stop on the road again, she had taken Lizzie up in front of her, cradling the girl's body against her as they rode, leading Lizzie's horse. Lizzie had alternately blazed with heat and shaken with chill, and both of them had arrived in Wilmington limp with exhaustion. But here they were, in the midst of Wilmington, and as far from real help as they had ever been. Bree glanced at the bedside table, lips tight. A wadded cloth lay there, dabbled with blood. The landlady had taken one look at Lizzie and sent for an apothecary. Despite what her mother had said about the primitive state of medicine and its practitioners here, Brianna had felt a sudden instinctive surge of relief at the sight of the man. The apothecary was a decently dressed young man, with a kindly air and reasonably clean hands. No matter what his state of medical knowledge, he was likely to know as much about fevers as she herself did. More important, she could feel that she wasn't alone in caring for Lizzie. Modesty prompted her to step outside when the apothecary drew forth the linen sheet to make his examination, and it wasn't until she heard a small cry of distress that she flung open the door to find the young apothecary, fleam in hand, and Lizzie, her face white as chalk, red blood streaming from a cut in the crook of her elbow. "But it is to draw the humours, miss," the apothecary had pleaded, trying to shield both himself and the body of his patient. "Do you not understand? You must draw the humours. If it is not done, hot bile will toxify within her organs and fill her body entirely to her certain detriment." "It'll be to your certain detriment if you don't leave," Brianna had informed him through clenched teeth. "Get out of here this minute." Medical zeal disappearing in favour of self-preservation, the young man had picked up his case and left with what dignity he could, pausing at the foot of the stairs to shout dire warnings up at her. The warnings kept echoing in her ears between trips downstairs to fill the basin from the kitchen copper. Most of the apothecary's words were simple ignorance, ranting about humours and bad blood. But there were some that came back with uncomfortable force. "If you will not take heedful advice, miss, you may well condemn your maid to death," he had called, indignant face upturned in the darkness of the stairwell. "You do not know how to care for her yourself." She didn't. She didn't even know for sure what Lizzie's sickness was. The apothecary had called it an ague, and the landlady had talked of seasoning. It was quite common for new immigrants to fall ill repeatedly, exposed as they were to an unfamiliar array of new germs. From the landlady's unguarded remarks, it seemed apparent that it was also quite common for such immigrants not to survive this seasoning process. The basin tilted, slopping hot water over her wrists. Water was the only thing she had. God knew whether the well behind the inn was sanitary or not. Better to use the boiling water from the copper and let it cool, even if it took longer. There was cool water in the pitcher. She dribbled a little between Lizzie's dry, cracked lips, then eased the girl down on the bed. She washed Lizzie's face and neck, pulled back the quilt, and soaked the linen nightdress again, the tiny nipples showing as dark pink points beneath. Lizzie managed a small smile, eyelids drooping, then sank back with a tiny sigh and fell asleep, loose joints relaxing like a rag doll's. Brianna felt as though her own stuffing had been removed as well. She dragged the single stool over to the window and collapsed on it, leaning on the sill in a vain effort to get a breath of fresh air. The atmosphere had lain on them like a thick blanket all the way from Charleston. Little wonder that poor Lizzie had crumpled under its weight. She scratched uneasily at a bite on her own thigh. The bugs weren't nearly as fond of her as they were of Lizzie, but she had suffered a few bites. Malaria wasn't a danger. She'd had the shots for that as well as for typhoid, cholera, and anything else she could think of. But there was no vaccine for things like dengue fever, or any of a dozen other diseases that haunted the thick air like malevolent spirits. How many of those were spread by biting insects? She closed her eyes and leaned her head against the wooden frame, blotting trickles of sweat from her breastbone with the folds of her shirt. She could smell herself. How long had she been wearing these clothes? It didn't matter. She'd been awake for most of 2 days and 2 nights, and was too tired to undress, let alone make the effort to wash. Lizzie's fever seemed to have broken. But for how long? If it kept coming back, it was sure to kill the little maidservant. She had already lost all the weight she had gained on the voyage, and her fair skin was beginning to show a yellow tinge in sunlight. There was no help to be found in Wilmington. Brianna sat up straight, stretching and feeling the bones of her back pop into place. Tired or not, there was only one thing to do. She had to find her mother, and as quickly as possible. She would sell the horses and find a boat to take them up the river. Even if the fever came back, she could take care of Lizzie as well on a boat as she could in this hot, smelly little room, and they would still be travelling toward their goal. She got up and splashed a little water on her face, twisting her sweat-soaked hair up out of the way. She loosened the crumpled breeches and stepped out of them, making plans in a dreamy, disconnected sort of way. A boat on the river. Surely it would be cooler on the river. No more riding. Her thigh muscles ached from 4 days in the saddle. They would sail to Cross Creek, find Jocasta Mackenzie. "Aunt," she murmured, swaying slightly as she reached for the oil-dipped lamp. "Great Aunt Jocasta." She imagined a kindly, white-haired old lady who would greet her with the same joy she had found at Lallybroch. Family. It would be so good to have family again. Roger drifted into her thoughts, as he did so often. She resolutely pushed him out again. Time enough to think of him when her mission was accomplished. A tiny cloud of gnats hovered over the flame, and the wall nearby was spattered with the arrowed shapes of moths and lacewings, taking respite from their quest. She pinched out the flame, scarcely hotter than the air in the room, and pulled the shirt off over her head in darkness. Jocasta would know exactly where Jamie Fraser and her mother were, would help her get to them. For the first time since stepping through the stones, she thought of Jamie Fraser with neither curiosity nor trepidation. Nothing mattered but finding her mother. Her mother would know what to do for Lizzie. Her mother would know how to take care of everything. She spread a folded quilt on the floor and lay down naked on it. She was asleep in moments, dreaming of the mountains and clean white snow. By the next evening, things looked better. The fever had broken, just as before, leaving Lizzie spent and weak, but clear-headed and as cool as the climate allowed. Restored by a night's rest, Brianna had washed her hair and sponge-bathed in the basin, then had paid the landlady to keep an eye on Lizzie, while she, dressed in breeches and coat, went about her business. It had taken most of the day, and the suffering of a good many widened eyes and gaping mouths, as men realized her sex, to sell the horses at what she hoped was an honest price. She had heard of a man named Vjost, who took passengers between Wilmington and Cross Creek in his canoe for a price. She hadn't found Vjost before dark, though, and wasn't about to hang around the docks at night, breeches or no breeches. Morning would be time enough. Still more heartening, Lizzie had been downstairs when she returned to the inn toward sunset, being cosseted by the landlady, and fed morsels of corn pudding and chicken fricassee. "You're better," Brianna exclaimed. Lizzie nodded, beaming, and gulped her mouthful. "I am, Sue," she said. "I feel quite myself again, and Mrs. Smuts has been so kind as to let me wash all of our things. Oh, it's so nice to feel clean again," she said fervently, laying a pale hand on her kerchief, which looked freshly ironed. "You shouldn't be washing and ironing," Brianna scolded, sliding into the bench beside her maid. You'll wear yourself out and get sick again. Lizzie looked down her thin nose. A prim smile perched at the corners of her mouth. Well, didn't think you'd be wanting to meet your da in clothes all spotted with filth. Not but what even a clarty gown would be better than what you've got on.
The little maid's eyes passed reprovingly over Brianna's breeches. She didn't approve at all of her mistress's penchant for male costume.
Meet my da. What do you... Lizzie, have you heard something?
A flare of hope shot up inside her, a sudden bright puff like the lighting of a gas stove.
Lizzie looked smug. I have that, and 'twas all because of the washing too. My dad did always say as how virtue brings its reward.
I'm sure it does, Brianna said dryly.
What did you find out, and how? Well, I was just after hanging out your petticoat, the nice one, aye, with a lace about the hem.
Brianna picked up a small jug of milk and held it menacingly over her maid's head. Lizzie squeaked and ducked away, giggling.
All right! I'm telling, I'm telling!
In the middle of her washing, one of the tavern's patrons had come out into the yard to smoke a pipe, the day being fine. He had admired Lizzie's domestic skills and taken up a pleasant conversation, in the course of which it was revealed that this gentleman, one Andrew McNeil by name, had not only heard of James Fraser, but was well acquainted with him.
He is? What did he say? Is this McNeil still here?
Lizzie put out a hand and made small quelling motions.
I'm saying it as quick as I can. No, he's not here. I did try to make him stay, but he was bound for New Bern by the packet boat and couldn't abide.
She was nearly as excited as Brianna. Her cheeks were still pale and sallow, but the tip of her nose had gone pink.
Mr. McNeil knows your da, and your great-auntie Cameron as well. She's a great lady, he says, very rich, with a tremendous great house and lots of slaves, and... Never mind about that now.
What did he say about my father? Did he mention my mother?
Claire, Lizzie said triumphantly. He did say that was your mam's name. I asked, and he said yes, Mrs. Fraser's name was Claire. And he said she was a most amazing healer. Did you not see as your mother was a fine physician? He said, as he had seen her do a desperate operation on a man, laid him smack in the middle of the dinner table, and cut off his bollocks, and then stitched them back on, right there on the spot, with all the dinner party looking on.
That's my mother, all right. There were tears of what might have been laughter in the corners of her eyes.
Are they well? Had he seen them lately? Oh, that's the best of it.
Lizzie leaned forward, eyes big with the importance of her news.
He's in Cross Creek, your da, Mr. Fraser. A man he knows is on trial there for assault, and your da's come down to be witness for him.
She patted her handkerchief against her temple, mopping up tiny beads of sweat.
Mr. McNeil says the court will na sit again till Monday week, because the judge fell ill, and another is coming from Edenton, and the trial canna go on until he arrives.
Brianna brushed back a lock of hair and drew out her breath, hardly daring to believe their luck. A week from Monday. And it's Saturday now. God, I wonder how long it will take to get upriver.
Lizzie crossed herself hastily in atonement for her mistress's casual blasphemy, but shared in her excitement. I dinna ken, but Mrs. Smoots did say as her son's made the trip once before. We can ask him.
Brianna swung round on her bench, looking over the room. Men and boys had begun coming in as darkness fell, stopping for a drink or a supper on their way from work to bed. And now there were 15 or 20 people crammed into the small space.
"Which one is Junior Smoots?"
Brianna asked, craning her neck to see through the press of bodies.
"Yonder, the laddie with the sweet brown eyes. I'll fetch him to you, shall I?"
Emboldened by excitement, Lizzie slipped out of her seat and pushed her way into the throng. Brianna was still holding the jug of milk, but made no move to pour it into her cup. Her throat was too choked with excitement to swallow.
Little more than a week!
Wilmington was a small town, Roger thought. How many places could she be? If she was here at all... He thought there was a good chance of it. Inquiries in the Dockside taverns in New Bern had given him the valuable information that the Philip Alonso had reached Charleston safely, and only 10 days before the Gloriana had docked in Edenton. It might have taken Brianna anything from 2 days to 2 weeks to make her way from Charleston to Wilmington, assuming that she was indeed headed there. "She's here," he muttered. "Damn it, I know she's here." Whether this conviction was the result of deduction, intuition, hope, or merely stubbornness, he clung to it like a drowning sailor to a spar. He had managed the journey from Edenton to Wilmington with a fair amount of ease himself. Put to work unloading cargo from the Gloriana's hold, he had carried a chest of tea into a warehouse, set it down, walked back to the door, and busied himself in retying the sweat-soaked kerchief round his head. As soon as the next man had passed him, he stepped out onto the dock, turned right instead of left, and within seconds was headed up the narrow cobbled lane that led from docks to town. By the next morning, he found a berth as a loader on a small cargo boat transporting naval stores from Edenton to the main depot at Wilmington, there to be transferred to a larger ship for transport to England. He jumped ship again in Wilmington without a moment's compunction. He hadn't time to waste. There was Brianna to be found. He knew she was here. Fraser's Ridge was in the mountains. She'd need a guide, and Wilmington was the most likely port in which to find one. And if she was here, someone would have noticed her. He'd bet money on that. He could only hope the wrong sort of person hadn't noticed her already. A quick reconnoiter of the main street and the harbour gave him a count of 23 taverns. Christ, these people drank like fish. There was the chance she'd taken a room in a private house, but the taverns were the place to start. By evening, he'd covered 10 of the taverns, slowed by the necessity of avoiding any of his erstwhile shipmates. Being in the presence of so much drink, and he without an extra penny to spend, had given him a raging thirst. He hadn't eaten all day either, which didn't help matters. At the same time, he scarcely noticed the physical discomfort. A man in the 5th tavern had seen her. So had a woman in the 7th. "A tall man with red hair," the man had said. But, "A great huge girl dressed in men's breeches," the woman had said, clicking her tongue in shock. "Walking down the street plain as you please, with her coat over her arm and her backside in view of everyone." Let Roger get that particular backside in his view, he thought, with some grimness, and he'd know what to do with it. He begged a cup of water from a kind-hearted landlady and set off with renewed determination. By the time it was full dark, he had covered another 5 taverns. The tap rooms were full now, and he discovered that the tall red-headed girl in men's clothing had been causing public comment for nearly a week. The quality of some of this comment caused the blood to throb in his cheeks with outrage, and only the fear of being arrested kept him from outright assault. As it was, he left the 15th tavern after an ugly exchange of words with 2 drunkards, boiling with fury. Christ! Had the woman no sense at all? Did she have no notion what men were capable of? He stopped in the street and wiped a sleeve across his sweating face. He breathed heavily, wondering what to do next. Keep on, he supposed, though if he didn't find something to eat soon, he was going to fall flat on his face in the road. The Blue Bull, he decided. He'd glanced into the shed there as he passed earlier, and seen a good pile of clean straw. He'd spend a penny or two for dinner, and perhaps the owner would let him sleep in the stable for the sake of Christian kindness. Turning, his eye caught sight of a sign on the house across the road. "Wilmington Gazetteer, Jonathan Gillette, proprietor," it read. "Wilmington's newspaper, one of the few in the colony of North Carolina. One too many, if you ask Roger." He fought the urge to pick up a rock and hurl it through Jonathan Gillette's window. Instead, he yanked the sodden band off his head and, making an effort to tidy himself into some semblance of decency, turned toward the river and the Blue Bull. She was there. She was sitting by the hearth, her tailed hair sparkling in the firelight, engaged in conversation with a young man whose smile Roger wanted to wipe off forcibly.
Instead, he slammed the door behind him with a crash and started toward her.
She turned, startled, and stared blankly at the bearded stranger. Recognition flashed in her eyes, then joy, and a huge smile spread across her face. "Oh," she said, "it's you."
Then her eyes changed as realization flared up like a brush fire. She screamed. It was a good, full-bodied scream, and every head in the tavern snapped round at the sound of it.
"Damn you!"
He lunged across the table and got her by the arm.
"What the devil do you think you're doing?"
Her face had gone dead white, her eyes round and dark with shock. She jerked away, trying to free herself.
"Let go!"
"That I won't. You'll come with me, and you'll do it this moment."
Sidling round the table, he got hold of her other arm, jerked her up, whirled her around, and pushed her in front of him toward the door.
"Mackenzie!"
Damn! It was one of the seamen from the cargo boat. Roger glowered at the man, willing him to keep out of it. Luckily, the man was both smaller and older than Roger. He hesitated, but then took courage from the company and lifted his chin pugnaciously.
"What are you doing to the lass, Mackenzie? Leave her be!"
There was a stir among the crowd, men turning from their drinks, attracted by the uproar. He had to get out of here now, or he wouldn't get out at all.
"Tell them it's all right. Tell them you know me,"
he whispered into Brianna's ear.
"It's all right," Brianna spoke, voice husky with shock, but loud enough to be heard over the growing hubbub. "It's all right. I know him."
The seaman dropped back a little, still dubious.
A scrawny young girl in the inglenook had gotten to her feet. She looked frightened to death, but bravely clutched a stone ale bottle in one fist, evidently intending to hit Roger with it, if necessary. Her high-pitched voice rang out above the suspicious grumble of voices.
"Miss Bree, you'll no go wi' yon black villain, surely?"
Brianna made a sound that might have been laughter, choked by hysteria. Reaching up, she dug her nails hard into the back of his hand. Startled by the pain, he loosened his grip, and she yanked her arm out of his grasp.
"It's all right," she repeated more firmly to the room at large. "I know him."
She made a small shooing gesture at the girl.
"Lizzie, go on up to bed. I'll be back later."
She whirled on her boot heel and headed for the door, walking fast. Roger gave the tap room a menacing glare to discourage anyone who thought of interfering, and followed her. She was waiting right outside the door. Her fingers sank into his arm with a fierceness that might have been gratifying were it prompted solely by joy at seeing him. He doubted it.
"What are you doing here?"
she asked.
He detached her fingers from his arm and gripped them firmly.
"Not here," he snapped.
He took her arm and dragged her a little way down the road to the shelter of a big horse chestnut tree. The sky still glowed with the remnants of twilight, but the drooping branches reached nearly to the ground, and it was dark enough underneath to hide them from any curious souls who thought of venturing after them. She whirled on him the instant they reached its shadows.
"What are you doing here, for God's sake?"
"Looking for you, you wee fool.
And what in the name of all holy are you doing here?
And dressed like that, God damn you!"
He'd had the briefest look at her in her breeches and shirt, but it was enough. In her own time, the clothes would have been so baggy as to be sexless. After months of seeing women in long skirts and arasaiches, though, the blatant division of her legs, the sheer bloody length of thigh and curve of calf seemed so outrageous that he wanted to wrap a sheet around her.
"Bloody woman, you might as well walk down the street naked.
Don't be an idiot. What are you doing here?"
"I told you, looking for you."
He took her by the shoulders then and kissed her, hard. Fear, anger, and the sheer relief of finding her were fused at once into a solid bolt of desire, and he found he was shaking with it. So was she. She was clinging to him, shaking in his arms.
"It's all right," he whispered to her.
He buried his mouth in her hair.
"It's all right. I'm here. I'll take care of you."
She jerked upright out of his arms.
"All right," she cried. "How can you say that? For God's sake, you're here!" There was no mistaking the horror in her voice. He grabbed her by the arm.
"And where the hell else should I be? With you tearing off into fucking nowhere and risking your bloody neck and... Why the hell did you do it?"
"I'm looking for my parents. What else should I be doing here?"
"I know that, for God's sake. I mean, why in hell did you not tell me what you meant to do?"
She jerked her arm out of his grasp and gave him a healthy shove in the chest that all but sent him staggering. "Because you wouldn't have let me go, that's why. You'd have tried to stop me and..."
"Damn right I would. God, I'd have locked you in a room or tied you hand and foot. Of all the flea-brained notions."
She hit him, a full-palm slap that caught him hard across the cheekbone.
"Shut up! Bloody woman! Do you expect me to let you go off into nothing? And I sit at home twiddling my thumbs while you're having your womb paraded on a pike in the marketplace? What sort of man do you think I am?"
He felt her movement rather than saw it, and grabbed her wrist before she could slap him again.
"I'm in no mood for that, girl. Hit me once more, and by Christ, I will do you violence."
She folded her other hand into a fist and punched him in the belly, quick as a striking snake. He wanted to hit her back. Instead, he grabbed her, and with a handful of her hair wrapped round his fist, kissed her as hard as he could. She squirmed and struggled against him, making strangled noises, but he didn't stop. Then she was kissing him back, and they sank to their knees together. Her arms came round his neck as he bore her down beneath him to the leaf-matted ground beneath the tree. Then she was crying in his arms, choking and gasping, tears running down her face as she clutched at him.
"Why?" she sobbed. "Why did you have to follow me? Didn't you realize? Now what are we going to do?"
"Do? Do about what?"
He couldn't tell whether she was crying from anger or fear. Both, he thought. She stared up at him through strands of tangled hair.
"Getting back. You have to have somebody to go to. Somebody you care for. You're the only person I love at that end. Or you were. How am I going to get back if you're here? And how will you get back if I'm here?"
He stopped dead, fear and anger both forgotten, and his hands clamped tight on her wrists to stop her hitting him again.
"That's why. That's why you wouldn't tell me. Because you love me. Jesus Christ."
He let go of her wrists and lay on top of her instead. He grabbed her face with both hands and tried to kiss her again. She gave a sudden snap of her hips, swung her legs up on either side, and scissored him neatly across the back, crushing his ribs. He rolled, breaking the hold, and brought her with him, ending on his back with her on top. He got a hand in her hair and drew her face down to his, panting.
"Stop," he said. "Christ, what is this? A wrestling match?"
"Let go of my hair." She shook her head, trying to dislodge his grip.
"I hate having my hair pulled."
He let go of her hair and slid his hand up the length of her neck, fingers curled round the slender nape, a thumb resting on the pulse in her throat. It was going like a trip hammer. So was his.
"Right. How are you on being choked?"
"Don't like it."
"Neither do I. Get your arm off my neck, aye?"
Very slowly, her weight eased back. He still felt short of breath, but not from being choked. He didn't want to let go of her neck, not from fear of her cutting loose again, but because he couldn't bear to lose the feel of her. It had been too long. She reached up and took hold of his wrist, but didn't pull his hand away. He felt her swallow.
"Right," he whispered. "Say it. I want to hear it." "I love you," she said, between her teeth. "Got it?" "Aye, I've got it."
He took her face between his hands very gently and drew her down. She came, arms trembling and giving way beneath her.
"You're sure?" he said.
"Yes." "What are we going to do?"
she said, and began to cry.
"We." She'd said we. She'd said she was sure.
Roger lay in the dust of the road, bruised, filthy, and starving, with a woman trembling and weeping against his chest, now and then giving him a small thump with her fist. He had never felt happier in his life.
"Hush," he whispered, half rocking her. "It's all right. There's another way. We'll get back. I know how. Don't worry. I'll take care of you."
Finally, she wore herself out and lay still in the crook of his arm, sniffling and hiccuping. There was a large wet spot on the front of his shirt. The crickets in the tree, startled into silence by the uproar, cautiously resumed their songs overhead. She freed herself and sat up, fumbling in the dark.
"I have to blow my nose," she said thickly. "Do you have a hanky?"
He gave her the damp rag he used to tie back his hair. She made whooshing noises, and he smiled in the dark.
"You sound like a can of shaving cream.
And when was the last time you saw one of those?" She lay down on him again, head tucked into the curve of his shoulder, and reached up to touch his jaw. He'd shaved 2 days ago. There had been neither time nor opportunity since. Her hair still smelled faintly of grass, though no longer of artificial flowers. It must be her natural scent. She sighed deeply, tightened her arm around him. "I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't want you to come after me. But, Roger, I'm awfully glad you're here." He kissed her temple. She was damp and salty with sweat and tears.
"So am I," he said.
And for the moment, all the trials and dangers of the past 2 months seemed insignificant. All but one.
"How long have you been planning this?" he asked.
He thought he could have told her to the day, since her letters had begun to change.
"Oh, about 6 months," she said, confirming his guess. "It was when I went to Jamaica during last Easter vacation."
"Aye, to Jamaica instead of to Scotland."
She'd asked him to join her, and he'd refused, foolishly hurt that she hadn't planned to come to him automatically. She took a deep breath and let it out, blotting the neck of her shirt against her skin. "I kept dreaming," she said, "about my father. Fathers, both of them." The dreams were little more than fragments, vivid glimpses of Frank Randall's face, longer stretches now and then, in which she saw her mother, and now and then a tall red-haired man whom she knew to be the father she had never seen. "There was one dream in particular." It had been night in the dream, somewhere tropical, with fields of tall green plants that might have been sugarcane, and fires burning in the distance. "There were drums beating, and I knew something was hiding, waiting in the canes. Something horrible," she said. "My mother was there, drinking tea with a crocodile." Roger grunted, and her voice grew sharper. "It was a dream, all right?" Then he stepped out of the canes. I couldn't see his face very well because it was dark, but I could see that he had red hair. There were copper glints when he turned his head.
"Was he the dreadful thing in the canes?" Roger asked.
"No."
He could hear the susurras of her hair as she shook her head. It had gone quite dark by now, and she was little more than a comforting weight on his chest, a soft voice beside him speaking from the shadows. "He was standing between my mother and the awful thing. I couldn't see it, but I knew it was there, waiting." She gave a small, involuntary shudder, and Roger tightened his hold on her. "Then I knew my mother was going to stand up and walk right toward it. I tried to stop her, but I couldn't make her hear me or see me. So I turned to him and I called him to go with her, to save her from whatever it was. And he saw me." The hand on his arm squeezed tight. "He did. He saw me and he heard me. And then I woke up."
"Aye," Roger said skeptically. "And this made you go to Jamaica and..."
"It made me think," she said sharply. "You looked. You couldn't find them anywhere in Scotland after 1766, and you couldn't find them on any of the emigration rolls to the colonies. That was when you said you thought we ought to give up, that there wasn't any more we could find out."
Roger was glad of the darkness that hid his guilt. He kissed the top of her head quickly. But I wondered. The place I saw them in the dream was in the tropics. What if they were in the Indies?
I looked, Roger said. I checked the passenger rules of every ship that left Edinburgh or London in the late 1760s and 70s. Headed for any place. I did tell you, he added, an edge in his voice.
I know that, she said, with a matching edge. But what if they weren't passengers? Why did people go to the Indies then? Now, I mean.
She caught herself, voice cracking a little in realization.
For trade, mostly.
Right. So, what if they went on a cargo ship? They wouldn't show up on the passenger rolls.
Okay, he said slowly. Right, they wouldn't. But then, how would you look for them?
Warehouse registers, plantation account books, port manifests. I spent the whole vacation in libraries and museums and...
And I found them, she said, with a small catch in her voice.
Christ, she'd seen the notice.
Aye, he said, striving for calmness. She laughed, a little tremulously. A captain, James Fraser, of a ship named Artemis, sold 5 tons of bat guano to a planter in Montego Bay on April the 2nd, 1767.
Roger couldn't help a grunt of amusement, but at the same time couldn't help objecting.
Aye, but a ship's captain. After all your mother said about the man's seasickness. And not to be discouraging, but there must be literally hundreds of James Frasers. How could you possibly know?
There might. But on April the 1st, a woman named Claire Fraser bought a slave from the slave market in Kingston.
She what?
I don't know why, Brianna said firmly. But I'm sure she had a good reason.
Well, sure, but...
The papers gave the slave's name as Temeraire, and described him as having one arm. Makes him stand out, doesn't it? Anyway, I started looking through collections of old newspapers, not just from the Indies, from all the southern colonies, looking for that name. My mother wouldn't keep a slave. If she bought him, she'd free him somehow, and the notices of manumission were sometimes printed in the local papers. I thought I could maybe find where the slave was freed.
And did you?
No.
She was quiet for a minute.
I found something else.
A notice of their deaths. My parents. Even knowing that she must have found it, to hear it from her lips was still a shock. He pulled her tight against him, wrapping his arms around her.
Where?
He said softly.
How?
He should have known better.
He wasn't listening to her half-choked explanation. He was too busy cursing himself. He should have known she was too stubborn to be dissuaded. All he'd done with his fat-headed interference was to drive her into secrecy. And it had been he who'd paid for that, in months of worry.
But we're in time, she said. It said 1776. We've got time to find them. She sighed hugely.
I'm so glad you're here.
I was so worried you'd find out before I could get back, and I didn't know what you'd do.
What I did do. You know, he said conversationally, I have a friend with a 2-year-old child. He says that he'd never in life condone child abuse, but by God, he understands what makes people do it. I feel very much the same about wife beating just now.
There was a small quiver of laughter from the heavy weight on his chest.
What do you mean by that?
He slid a hand down her back and got a firm grip on one round buttock. She wore no underclothes beneath the loose breeches.
I mean that were I a man of this time instead of my own, nothing would give me greater pleasure than to lay my belt across your arse 12 times or so.
She didn't seem to consider this a serious threat. In fact, he thought she was laughing.
So, since you're not from this time, you wouldn't do it?
Or you would, but you wouldn't enjoy it.
Oh, I'd enjoy it, he assured her. There's nothing I'd like better than to take a stick to you.
She was laughing. Suddenly furious, he shoved her off and sat up.
What's the matter with you?
I thought you'd found someone else. Your letters, the last few months. And then that last one. I was sure of it. It's that I want to beat you for... not for lying to me or going off without telling me. For making me think I'd lost you.
She was silent for a moment. Her hand came out of darkness and touched his face very softly.
I'm sorry, she said quietly. I never meant for you to think that. I only wanted to keep you from finding out until it was too late.
Her head turned toward him, silhouetted by the faint light from the road outside their refuge.
How did you find out?
Your boxes. They came to the college.
What? But I told them not to send those until the end of May, when you'd be in Scotland.
I would have been, only for a last-minute conference that kept me in Oxford. They came the day before I left.
There was a sudden spill of light and noise as the door of the tavern opened, disgorging a knot of patrons into the road. Voices and footsteps passed by their refuge startlingly close. Neither of them spoke until the sounds had disappeared. In the renewed silence, he heard the sound of a conker falling through the leaves, to bounce on the leaves nearby. Rihanna's voice was oddly husky.
You thought I'd found somebody else, and you still came after me?
He sighed, anger gone as suddenly as it had come, and wiped the damp hair off his face.
I'd have come if you were married to the King of Siam, bloody woman.
She was no more than a pale blur in the darkness. He saw the brief movement as she leaned to pick up the fallen conker and sat toying with it. Finally, she drew a very deep breath and let it out slowly.
You said wife-beating.
He paused. The crickets had stopped again.
You said you were sure. Did you mean it?
There was a silence, long enough to fill a heartbeat, long enough to fill forever.
Yes,
she said softly. In Inverness, I said...
You said you'd have me all, or not at all. And I said I understood. I'm sure.
Her shirt had pulled free of her breeches in their struggle, and billowed loose around her in the faint hot breeze. He reached under the floating hem and touched bare skin, which rippled into goose flesh at his touch. He pulled her close, ran his hands over bare back and bare shoulders under the cloth, and buried his face in her hair, her neck, exploring, asking with his hands, did she mean it? She gripped his shoulders and leaned back, urging him.
Yes, she did.
He answered, wordless, opening the front of her shirt, spreading it apart. Her breasts were white and soft.
Please, she said.
Her hand was at the back of his head, pulling him toward her.
Please.
If I take you now, it's for always, he whispered.
She scarcely breathed, but stood stock still, letting his hands go where they would.
Yes, she said.
The tavern door opened again, startling them apart. He let her go and stood up, reaching down a hand to help her, then stood with her hand in his, waiting, while the voices receded into distance.
Come on, he said,
and ducked under the drooping branches. The shed was some distance from the tavern, dark and quiet. They stopped outside, waiting, but there was no sound from the back of the inn. All the windows on the upper floor were dark.
I hope Lizzie's gone to bed.
He wondered dimly who Lizzie was, but didn't care. At this distance he could see her face clearly, though the night washed all colour from her skin. She looked like a harlequin, he thought, white cheek planes slashed by leaf shadows, framed by the dark of her hair. Her eyes, black triangles, set above a dash of vivid mouth. He took her hand in his, palm to palm.
Do you know what hand fasting is?
Not exactly. Sort of a temporary marriage.
A bit. In the Isles and the remoter parts of the Highlands, where folk were a long way from the nearest minister, a man and a woman now could be hand fast, vowed to each other for a year and a day. At the end of it, they find a minister and wed more permanently, or they go their own ways.
Her hand tightened in his. I don't want anything temporary.
Neither do I. But I don't think we'll find a minister easily. There are no churches here yet. The nearest minister is likely in New Bern.
He lifted their linked hands.
I did say I wanted it all, and if you didn't care enough to wed me...
Her hand tightened, hard. I do.
All right.
He took a deep breath and began.
I, Roger Jeremiah, do take thee, Brianna Ellen, to be my lawful wedded wife. With my goods I thee endow. With my body I thee worship.
Her hand twitched in his, and his balls tightened. Whoever had worded this vow had understood all right.
In sickness and in health, in richness and in poverty, so long as we both shall live. If I make a vow like that, I'll keep it, no matter what it costs me. Was she thinking of that now?
She brought their linked hands down together and spoke with great deliberation. I, Brianna Ellen, take thee, Roger Jeremiah. Her voice was scarcely louder than the beating of his own heart, but he heard every word. A breeze came through the trees, rattling the leaves, lifting her hair. As long as we both shall live. The phrase meant a good bit more to each of them now, he thought, than it would have even a few months before. The passage through the stones was enough to impress anyone with the fragility of life. There was a moment's silence, broken only by the rustle of leaves overhead, and a distant murmur of voices from the tavern's taproom. He raised her hand to his mouth and kissed it, on the knuckle of her fourth finger, where one day, God willing, her ring would be. It was more of a large shed than a barn, though some beast, a horse or mule, stirred in its stall at one end. There was a strong, clean tang of hops in the air, enough to overpower the milder scents of hay and manure. The blue bull brewed its own ale. Roger felt drunk, but not from alcohol. The shed was very dark, and undressing her was both frustration and delight.
"And I thought it took blind people years to develop a keen sense of touch," he murmured.
The warm breath of her laugh brushed his neck, making the tiny hairs at his nape stir and prickle. "You're sure it's not like the poem about the five blind men and the elephant?" she said. Her own hand groped, found the opening of his shirt, and slid inside.
"No, the beast is like a wall," she quoted.
Her fingers curved and flattened, curiously exploring the sensitive flesh around his nipple.
A wall with hair. Goodness, a wall with goosebumps, too.
She laughed again, and he bent his head, finding her mouth on the first try, sightless and unerring as a bat snatching a moth from the air.
Amphora,
he murmured, against the wide, sweet curve of her lips. His hand slid over the wide, sweet curve of her hips, cupping smoothness, cool and solid, timeless and graceful as the swell of ancient pottery, promising abundance.
Like a Grecian vase. God, you've got the most beautiful ass.
Jugbat, huh? She vibrated against him, the quiver of laughter passing from her lips to his and into his bloodstream like infection. Her hand slid down his own hip, and up, long fingers fumbling loose the flap of his breeches, groping hesitantly, and then more surely, gradually rucking his shirt up to disentangle him from the layers of fabric.
No, the beast is like a rope... Oops! Stop laughing, damn you!
Like a snake? No. Well, maybe a cobra. Gosh, what would you call that?
I had a friend once who called it Mr. Happy, Roger said, feeling light-headed. Well, that's a bit whimsical for my tastes.
He grabbed her by the arms and kissed her again, long enough to put a stop to any further comparisons. She was still quivering, but he didn't think it was laughter. He slid his arms around her and pulled her closely against him, amazed as always by the sheer size of her. A good deal more amazed now that she was naked. Those complex planes of bone and muscle transformed to immediate sensation in his arms. He paused for breath. He wasn't sure whether the sensation was more akin to drowning or to mountain climbing. But whatever it was, there wasn't much oxygen left between them.
"I've never been able to kiss a girl without stooping before," he said,
making conversation in hopes of getting his breath back.
"Oh, good. We wouldn't want you to have a stiff neck." The quiver was back in her voice, and it definitely was laughter, though he thought it stemmed as much from nervousness as humour. "Ha, ha," he said, and grabbed her again, oxygen be damned. Her breasts were high and round, pressed against his chest with that unique mixture of softness and firmness that so intrigued him whenever he touched her. One of her hands slid hesitantly between them, groping, then withdrew. He couldn't bring himself to stop kissing her long enough to finish undressing, but arched his back to let her push the breeches down over his hips. They were loose enough to fall in a puddle around his feet, and he stepped free of them, still holding her, only making a small noise in his throat when her hand came back between them. She had eaten onions with her dinner. Blindness sharpened not only touch, but taste and smell as well. He tasted roast meat and sour ale and bread, and a faint, sweet taste that he couldn't identify, that reminded him somehow of green meadows full of waving grass. Did he taste it, or smell it in her hair? He couldn't tell. He seemed to be losing track of his senses as he lost the boundaries between them, breathing her breath, feeling her heart beat as though it lay in his own chest. She was grasping him a trifle too tightly for comfort, and he broke the kiss at last, breathing heavily.
"Would you consider letting go for a moment? I grant you it's an effective handle, but it's got better uses."
Instead of letting go, she dropped to her knees. Roger made a slight move back, startled.
"Christ, are you sure you want to do that?"
He wasn't sure whether he hoped she did or not. Her hair tickled against his thighs, and his cock was quivering, desperate for engulfment. At the same time, he didn't want to frighten or repulse her.
"Don't you want me to?"
Her hands moved up the backs of his thighs, tentative and ticklish. He could feel every hair on his body spring erect from knees to waist. It made him feel like a satyr, goat-legged and reeking.
"Well, yes, but I haven't bathed in days," he said,
rather awkwardly, trying to detach himself. Deliberately, she brushed her nose over his stomach and down, inhaling deeply. His skin pebbled with goose flesh, the shiver having nothing to do with the temperature of the room.
"You smell good," she whispered, "like some kind of big male animal."
He grasped her head hard, fingers twisted in the thick silky hair.
"Do you write about that?" he whispered.
Her hand rested on his wrist, light and warm.
God, she was warm.
Without his actually intending it, his grip loosened. He felt the fall of her hair brush his thighs, and then stopped thinking anything coherent, as all of the blood left his brain heading south at a high rate of speed.
"Why are you in?"
"What?"
He came out of his daze a few moments later as she drew back, brushing the hair away from her face.
"I said, am I doing it right?"
"Oh, I think so."
"You think so? You don't know for sure?"
Brianna seemed to have been regaining her composure as fast as Roger had been losing his. He could hear the suppressed laughter in her voice.
"Well, no," he said. "I mean, I haven't. That is, no one's... Yeah, I think so."
He had hold of her head again, urging her gently forward. He thought she was making a low humming noise somewhere deep in her throat.
It might be his own blood, though, thrumming through distended veins, purling in violent eddies like the trapped water of the ocean, seething through the rocks. Another minute, and he was going off like a waterspout.
He pulled away, and before she could protest, lifted her to her feet, then urged her down onto the heap of straw where he had thrown her clothes. His eyes had adjusted to the dark. The starlight from the window was still so faint that he could see no more of her than shapes and outlines, white as marble.
Not cold, though. Not cold at all.
He approached his own duty with mingled excitement and caution. He had tried this exactly once, only to be met with a faceful of a feminine hygiene product that smelled like the flowers in his father's church on Sunday. An off-putting idea, if ever there was one. Brianna wasn't hygienic. The scent of her was enough to make him want to dispense with any preliminaries and throw himself on her in a pure abandonment of lust. Instead, he breathed deeply and kissed her just above the dark smudge of curls.
"Damn," he said.
"What is it?" She sounded faintly alarmed. "Do I smell terrible?" He closed his eyes and breathed. His head was spinning slightly, and he felt giddy with a combination of lust and laughter.
"No. It's only that I've been wondering for more than a year what colour your hair is here."
He tugged gently on the curls.
"Now, here I am, face to face with it, and I still can't tell."
She giggled, the vibration making her belly shake gently under his hand. "Do you want me to tell you?"
"No. Let me be surprised in the morning."
He bent his head to his work, surprised now by the amazing variety of textures, all in such a small space. A smoothness like glass, tickling roughness, a yielding rubberiness, and that sudden slippery slickness, musk and tang and salt together. After a few moments, he felt her hands come to rest gently on his head as though in benediction. He hoped the stubble of his beard wasn't hurting her, but she didn't seem to mind. A subterranean quiver ran through the warm flesh of her thighs, and she made a small sound that made a similar quiver dart through his belly.
"Am I doing it right?"
he inquired, half-jokingly, lifting his head.
"Oh, yeah," she said softly. "You sure are."
Her hands tightened in his hair. He had started to lower his head again, but jerked it up at this, staring up across the dim white reaches of her body toward the pale oval of her face.
"And just how the hell do you know that?" he asked.
His only answer was a deep gurgling laugh. Then he was beside her, with no real notion how he'd got there, his mouth on her mouth, the length of his body pressed to hers, aware only of the heat of her, burning like fever. She tasted of him and he of her, and God help him, he wasn't going to be able to go slowly. He did, though. She was eager but awkward, trying to lift her hips to him, touching him too quickly, too lightly. He took her hands, one at a time, and placed them flat against his chest. Her palms were hot and his nipples tightened.
"Feel my heart," he said.
His voice sounded thick to his own ears.
"Tell me if it stops."
He hadn't actually meant to be funny, and was faintly surprised when she gave a nervous laugh. The laugh disappeared as he touched her. Her hands tightened on his chest. Then he felt her relax, opening her legs to him.
"I love you," he murmured. "Oh, Bree, I do love you."
She didn't answer. But a hand floated up from the dark and lay along his cheek, gentle as a tendril of seaweed. She kept it there while he took her, laid open in trust, while her other hand held his beating heart. He felt more drunk than before. Not groggy or sleepy, though. Alive to everything. He could smell his own sweat. He could smell hers. Smell the faint tang of fear that tinged her desire. He closed his eyes and breathed, tightened his grip on her shoulders, pressed slowly, slid in, felt her tear
and bit his own lip hard enough to draw blood. Her fingernails dug into his chest.
"Go on,"
she whispered. One sharp, hard thrust, and he possessed her. He stayed that way, eyes closed, breathing, balanced on an edge of pleasure sharp.